Bat Segundo here, and I'm wondering if I've been approaching this women thing all wrong. All this time, I've thought that women were good for nothing more than cooking, cleaning, and performing fellatio. Please understand, I didn't initially have these views, which I understand are somewhat controversial in our age of apparent enlightenment, but this was, after all that my ex-wife was capable of. And Doris, as she testified on the stand, and as was proven by her attorney during some protracted and expensive litigation, is womanhood's most representative example. But perhaps I might be wrong. Maybe women are good for something more. Our young loving correspondent seems to think so, and I plan to listen carefully to this interview to see if I can pick up some helpful hints.
So I am here with two absolutely stunning ladies, Charlie Anders and Annalie Newitz, who are here to discuss their book, their anthology, She's Such a Geek, which they have edited. Charlie and Annalie, how are you doing?
Great, thanks
We're
for
awesome.
Having us.
First off, I wanted to basically start with a kind of general point. All the essays in this book use sort of empirical evidence to report on the gender divide as we see it in science and in culture and in technology. I wanted to put forth the question to you as to why this continues to exist in this supposedly enlightened era of the 21st century.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. Women have been working to enter the sciences, all types of sciences and engineering, you know, really for the past, say, 40 years or so. This has been a big issue where, you know, since feminist consciousness kind of became more mainstream in the 1960s. But it turns out that progress is a little more slow than we once believed. Say, in the 70s, I think there was this moment where a lot of women, which is when Charlie and I were kind of little girls, you know, a lot of women believe, like, it's just around the corner. We're going to have 50% representation in every possible field. And I think, you know, like I said, it's been a little bit slower than we thought. And, you know, in many scientific fields that are male-dominated, you have about 20 to 30% women working in the field, and many more than that getting degrees in scientific fields. About 50% of science and engineering degrees do go to women. Mm-hmm. So there's a big drop-off when they go into the workforce. And so really, that's the area where women need to be focusing now, is looking at the workforce, looking at academic jobs, and how to retain women once they've gotten their undergraduate degrees, just keep them doing science.
Well, is raising awareness like this book the first sort of step towards solving this problem, or is do we need to have a leaflet campaign here?
I think the book is a good tool for raising awareness, and I encourage you to give it to all of your friends. But also, yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem is the stereotype, which, you know, Larry Summers famously perpetuated a couple of years ago, the stereotype that women are naturally less adept at science and math. I see, you know, I blog surf all the time and web surf for the book's blog. And I see lots of people saying, well, but women just don't have the spatial sense. Yeah. You know, women can't rotate five-dimensional objects in their sleep, you know, the way men can. And I think stereotypes like that are really pervasive. And one way that the book hopefully helps is it does have lots and lots of first-person accounts by women who are like, and, you know, and I wasn't sure if I was going to be good at this. And then it turned out, oh, I was actually the best in my class. You know, oh, I went into this test and, oh, I was the top.
I argue, though, this is not just the present-day problem, but, you know, there's a long history of women scientists like Rosalind Franklin and Madame Curie that are falling by the wayside, that we need to have a sort of Women's History Month or a Women's Science History Month in order to actually sort of recognize these things. So, I mean, I guess I want to maybe put forth a question to both of you as to whether a sort of shift in the present will bring about a shift in the past, or perhaps corralling our sort of past perceptions of history might allow us to sort of dwell more realistically in our supposedly enlightened present.
I think that that's right. And one of the things that has happened, I mean, for example, the Norbert Wiener Award, which is sort of the Nobel Prize for Computer Science, went to a woman this year. It was mm-hmm. the first ever Norbert Wiener Award given to a woman. And, you know, her work she had done in the 1950s, and she's finally being recognized for it. And I think that one of the big points we wanted to make in this book is that female geeks have always been around. And there's never been a moment when we haven't been in everything from, you know, chemistry classes to science fiction conventions, and that it's time for us to just be a lot louder about it. So that's, I mean, that's really one of the double binds for women who are in a male-dominated geeky field, is that they're simultaneously told that they're freakish for being there and that they kind of stick out, mm-hmm. and at the same time they're told that they're invisible. And so how do you simultaneously stick out and be invisible? I don't know. I think as we work through these issues and more women get involved, we're going to start seeing that, you know, women not only are there, but they're not bizarre, that they're just the same types of people who've always been involved in these fields.
Maybe we could talk about the cultural archetypes that you raise in your essay, Anna Lee. You mentioned the Trinity from The Matrix is one of the, you know, last examples of a positive sort of female geek. I would also argue, though, that like Scarlett Thomas's novels, entirely by word of mouth, they feature female characters who are very much interested in science and code and technology and the troposphere and the end of Mrs. Y, and that this book has had a incredible sort of buzz throughout the blogosphere and has, you know, allowed Scarlett Thomas to sort of become a write about this particular issue. Mm-hmm. And I guess that since there's this undercurrent, I mean, we have the mainstream current of Larry Summers basically saying, oh yeah, women can't do math. And we have this undercurrent, this underground that is clearly represented in this book of people who say, yes, they do. And here, by the way, here are some examples. So what is the kind of, I guess, turning point, maybe culturally, towards connecting this mainstream with this kind of underground recognition?
I think it's going to be slow, but it's happening more and more. I think that eventually, I mean, the mainstream loves to eat the underground. And so, you know, in some ways, what we're doing here is saying, yeah, we want to sell out. we want female scientists to be getting, you know, huge grants and running their own departments and being, you know, big swinging dicks in the science scene and being in a position to hire men and mentor men as well as women. So I do see over the next, say, 20 to 30 years that we're going to really witness a huge transformation, because a lot of women who are being educated now are going to be tenured professors in 10 or 20 years, and they're going to be heading up labs and going into industry and really changing things. And in fact, one of the essays in this book is about a woman who started out as a systems administrator and worked her way up to running her own department and ended up hiring a lot of women. And it was almost completely women in her technical department at this business. And for her, it was really an example of how if you had a woman in a position of control, that it made it a lot easier to bring other women into the high-tech workplace. And I think that's what we want to see, is just that once you kind of break down one barrier, you know, you just get this flood of women who are coming in. So I don't know if they're all going to get to be like Trinity, but you know, having a lot of female system administrators is in some ways even better than having, you know, latex clad babes on motorcycles. Although I like that too. You like that, right, Charlie?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I could have. Well, we were talking earlier about how we had thought this would happen when with all of the feminism from the 1970s, and here we are 20 or 30 years later still discussing that. So can you really make that particular prediction? That
I think that you can. The NSF, National Science Foundation, has done a number of long-range studies looking at involvement of women in science, and one particularly great chart that I found when I was doing research for this book showed that women, it was looking at women with jobs in engineering and science starting from 1960 and going up through the mid-1990s. And it starts at basically zero and goes up to about 20 to 23% over that time. And so there is substantial transformation. That's one generation going from zero to 23% in an incredibly male-dominated field, in areas that require intensive education and dedication. So it's not like it's an easy thing, like going to, you know, work in the service industry, which I think is, you know, has a relatively low barrier to entry. Yeah. So I think we can definitely imagine over the next, you know, 30 or 40 years seeing another similar jump, so that we're almost at 50-50.
Well, since we're talking vocation, and to get the silent, laconic Charlie into this, Charlie, your essay sort of describes having to list your gender as male in a job, as a business reporter. And I wanted to actually ask about this whole macho sentiment and how this related to your particular employment, and how this macho sentiment may have something to do with this broader issue of like getting going from zero to 20% in the science and technology fields.
Yeah, well, actually, I was reporting on the healthcare industry, and actually still write about the healthcare industry in my day job. And What I found was that there was a lot of complexity and a lot of kind of intricacy in the healthcare system that people weren't really, especially my editors at that paper, weren't really interested in hearing about. And they wanted it to be more kind of hard news and kind of more, it was a very macho environment. And part of the macho attitude was like a lack of interest in kind of delving into the intricacies of a lot of topics. And so I definitely found that as I transitioned my gender, I also kind of developed a persona that was more interested in sort of nuances and exploring the reasons behind things. And I'm not sure how that plays into the barriers to entry for women in the sciences, except that perhaps there's a lack of interest in questioning the reasons behind them. It's the same kind of impulse. It's the George Bush impulse of sort of make a decision and then, you know, 10 years later, possibly study the ramifications.
I should clarify my question, because you observe in your essay that basically there's this macho sentiment of not doing the sort of in-depth investigation because you're a man, you're supposed to sort of turn and work around, whereas you really wanted to sort of plunge into the depths and actually do the real reporting.
Yeah,
and
how definitely.
This sort of attention to detail is a quote female sort of thing viewed by these men newspapers. So I mean, given that sort of, you know, association, given the Larry Summers association, maybe both of you can sort of remark upon how we could just destroy and demolish this particular social block. Because I mean, clearly you know you're up against a lot if you're a woman and you want to go ahead and do this particular work, because there's this cocksure sort of attitude.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, actually one thing that comes up again and again in the essays in our book and from talking to people since the book has come out, one thing that comes up again and again is that women are socialized not to be as confident and not to kind of raise their hand and not to like assert that they have the answer and that, you know, they know and that they're right. You know, there's kind of a stigma around doing that if you're a woman, and that is, especially in the sciences, is kind of a very highly prized skill, the ability to kind of stand up and say, okay, I know, I figured it out.
Even if you don't really know.
Even if you don't know, especially if you don't know. In fact, often in some geek circles, there seems to be an inverse proportion to between the degree of confidence and the degree of knowledge of the subject area. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of geeks are incredibly knowledgeable people, but then you also run into people who are, you know, the less they know, the more they kind of bluster about their knowledge.
Yeah, we call it geek answer syndrome, where, you know, people will have answers to everything regardless of their area of expertise. You know, it's like, well, I understand computer networks, therefore I can talk about the Korean political situation. Let me explain. Yeah. It all works like a computer network.
Exactly.
I mean, and I think that, you know, last year there was a Pew Internet Life survey that looked at gender issues, it made a big splash at the time because people were very concerned. But one of the interesting things that came out of that study was, first of all, that younger women, women under about 23, are actually going online more often than men of that same cohort. And also that women with relatively equal skills with computers have about 20% less likelihood of saying that they're confident about those skills than men do. Yeah. And so there's really, you know, I hate to sound like a sort of cheesy wonk here, but there's a confidence problem. There's a confidence gap where, you know, women just simply aren't speaking up. And I think there's a lot of different ways to solve this. One is that I think that given that so many science fields and also other kinds of geeky fields, like even, say, comic book writing, which is something that we deal with in this book, or science fiction fandom, I think that men who are in charge in those fields need to be thinking more about mentoring women. And I think one of the things that we talk about a lot when we discuss this book is how there's a lot of social barriers to that act of men mentoring women, even if many men in these fields would be eager to have more women in them. I don't think it's a conspiracy of sexism at all, but I think that there is a stigma against older men or more experienced men helping out younger women because people immediately think there's something sexual going on, you know, because there's such a longstanding cultural myth that a man would never really be interested in a woman other than to have sex with her. Yeah. And even though there's many counterexamples, and of course, you know,
let's cite some examples of this stigma. Can you name a few specifically that come to mind, just so, you know, our Doubting Thomas listeners can sort of decide.
Well, I think it's anecdotal, right? I think certainly there's examples in sort of mass culture where you have everything from, oh God, what's that terrible Michael Caine movie where educating Rita, you know, that kind of idea.
Isn't there that new Peter O'Toole movie too?
Venus, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of films and books in that vein, the kind of, the myth of Pygmalion, you know, that the man wants to create this woman, but really he wants to create her to fuck her, not to help her become his equal and help her also become a mad scientist who can build her own guy or whatever. But I think within, say, academia, which is where mentoring is very important, particularly in the sciences, it really comes in the form of myths and rumors and, people... just making assumptions and talking behind each other's backs. And also, you know, men are very hyper-conscious of not being accused of sexual harassment because there have been so many high-profile cases. And so I think that they shy away from getting into those relationships, even if their intentions are completely innocent and completely benign. Mm-hmm. And I think that women also shy away from it because they're afraid they'll be accused of sleeping with this professor to get treats, you know, to get grant money or whatever. And I think that we just need to realize that those are myths and that if a man is mentoring a woman, maybe he's just doing it because she's really smart. Yeah. And, you know, until we can break down that myth a bit more, showing counter stories in which, men mentor women and it's great and the woman grows up to be a fantastic scientist, you're going to have a problem because so many of the people in charge in the sciences are men. Yeah. So some women are going to have to be mentored by men.
But we're also speaking in terms of stories or culture or empirical examples. This doesn't, I mean...
We're talking in terms of stereotypes, not reality. And I think that's why, we need to have kind of counter stories, images and myths that show the other side, because I think people are so powerfully persuaded by stereotypes and myths. And so... that's one of the reasons why many of the people in our book talk about fictional stories about women scientists and women geeks that have inspired them. And certainly that's what my essay is about. But I think that that's an important element that we need to have those stories circulating too.
Also, I wanted to also go back to this issue of sex as a obstacle to gender relations. There are a number of essays in there that deal with this particular topic. There's Mara Paulson's essay that describes having to remain silent as a video game designer while her male counterparts are sitting there designing these jiggly breasts on
the screen. Octopus.
Yes, exactly. You have Rupa Ramonthuri describes this, similarly sort of sexless expectations she had to endure while studying engineering in India. And you also have, of course, the Violet Blue essay in which the male-driven porn industry seems to be ahead of the curve technologically, but yet application-wise, they don't really sort of consider the pleasure for both genders. So I guess what I wanted to ask you about is sort of how these sort of pinpoint the kind of finer details here that are going on. What specifically, how much of this sort of divide that we're discussing here is really based upon these notions of sex in our culture?
Well, one thing we were really happy with in the book is that there's a whole wide variation of responses to sexuality. So on the one hand, you have Suzanne Franks, who like sort of has an orgasm when she does math problems and gets really excited by them.
So great.
And, Violet Blue, who is like relentlessly sex positive and wants there to be sort of a sexual application and then for technology. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you do have people like Mara Paulson, who is kind of objecting to the sexualization of female characters in video games. Yeah. And it's kind of interesting because I don't think any of the contributors in our book want to sort of leave their sexuality behind or become, sexless, androids in the workplace or in their areas of hobby or whatever.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think Quinn Norton sort of talks in her essay about how her sex life and her role-playing game experiences kind of, interacted and in some cases collided because she was sleeping with some of the people she was doing Dungeons and Dragons or LARPing with. Yeah. And that sometimes led to some friction. Basically I think that, we have to acknowledge sexuality and accept it, but not, it's like everything else, not have the attitude that sort of women's sexuality is there to be kind of presented and commodified and As in the breast octopus, which is, I should explain that. That's this thing, Mara Polson's essay, she talks about working at a video game company where they had this, you know,
she
these
was a
characters,
game developer.
They had characters whose breasts would sort of jiggle, like, kind of fantastically as they jumped around. And there was a thing where at the end of every round, the character would sort of snap back to the center of the arena or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you did it the right way, you could get her breasts to sort of twist into an octopus and like do some bizarre configurations because her breasts were so kind of unrealistic. And the video game designers would sit there for hours trying to make her breasts do the most ridiculous shapes they could think of. And that was the company that also had the nude biking game where like naked women were doing
BMX XXX.
Doing dirt bike racing.
Which we should also observe tanked big time too.
Yeah, it didn't do well. Nobody wanted a naked dirt bike game. I mean, who knew? Who knew? It's kind of
didn't
shocking.
Didn't they see Ghost Rider? Because that's like as naked as you can get. It's like a skeleton on a motorcycle.
But he's not naked. It would have been great if he was naked.
That would have actually been great. I just wanted to add a quick
plug for Ghost Rider.
I actually did like Ghost Rider, but a quick response to what Charlie was saying about sexuality, which is that I think one of the big things is that women are constantly having to think about their sexuality when they go into work, and men don't really. And one of the and women also have to think about their gender presentation. I can't tell you how many times women have asked us about gender presentation when we've talked about this book and have said, "Well, should you dress like a man or dress like a woman, or how do women negotiate and navigate these gender presentations and sexual issues in the workplace?" And I think we want to get to a place where women don't have to worry about any of that crap, that they can just go into a workplace and not have to worry that people are thinking, is she going to become sexual? And what does it mean that she's wearing a dress or that she's not wearing a dress, or, you know, to even think about her in that way, while at the same time not turning her into someone who's sexless, you know?
But this is really troubling to me, because it should not be about presentation. It should be about performance. So these women who are asking these questions should just go ahead and say, oh, you know, fuck it. I'm just going to go ahead and let my performance speak for itself.
And that's the place that we want to get to. And I think that there are women in scientific and high-tech workplaces that have achieved that, and that's fantastic. But I think that it's still a big issue that women have to worry about how people will respond to the way they look much more than men do.
Yeah.
And that women have to worry about how people perceive their sex lives much more than men do. And I, you know, this is all just holdovers from, you know, a history of sexism where women have been sex objects and men have been sex subjects.
Yeah.
And, you know, thankfully all that is changing. And certainly I didn't grow up feeling like I had to be a sex doll in any way. You know, I had many choices offered to me, but I still think that in a male dominated environment, women have to ask those questions a lot more than they should. And it just, you know, there needs to be some way to get out of that bind, to be able to be sexual, but not sexualized in a way that you don't want. So I don't know what the answer is, other than, you know, to turn into a flaming skeleton on a motorcycle.
That is
Ghost Rider is the template
the
for new.
To everything.
Yeah,
that is the answer to everything, pretty much. Yeah.
Well, I actually want to ask both of you, based off of what you just said, Annalie, and that is, you say that there are certain science and technological fields where presentation doesn't matter. In the course of sort of compiling these essays in this book, I mean, obviously you looked at candidates that you didn't, you know, put in the book. Did you find any sort of particular geeky-oriented fields where women had to still rely very much on presentation? Or
I'm not sure there was a particular field. It was across all fields.
Yeah,
it was all. There was a pervasive sort of emphasis on how you look. And actually, one thing that we were really excited about in this book was that, again, we had the diversity of attitudes to gender presentation, where there were some people who were just like, I'm a tomboy, I want to dress like a guy, I want to, you know, I don't want to be feminine in the workplace, I'm just going to dress as neutrally as possible. And then we have people who, I think it's Diana Huseman, who is like, I'm going to wear my flowiest, longest dresses, and I'm going to dress as femmy as possible all the time. And, you know, she confronts situations again and again where people refuse to take her seriously as a geek and as someone who's like capable of doing the heavy lifting, like literally, but also figuratively, because she's wearing these flowy dresses and sandals. And she finally like shows that, well, actually there's all sorts of situations where my attire is more practical than yours. And also I'm really smart and capable and you should take me seriously, even though I'm dressed in a feminine way. And, you know, then there are people like Morgan Romine, am I pronouncing it right?
I think it's Romine.
Romine, who, you know, founded the Frag Dolls and talks about using her femininity inside of an online, in an online role-playing game. Like, it's not World of Warcraft, but it's sort
of similar.
It's like
a predecessor,
it's
yeah.
It's a proto World of Warcraft. And she talks about, you know, sort of shamelessly using her femininity in that situation. And it's sort of an interesting counterpoint to the people who either don't want to be feminine or don't want their femininity to determine how they're treated. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that we have that kind of diversity of responses to this issue. There's no like right answer, I guess.
There is no right answer. I think the right answer is that you need to be comfortable with how you're presenting yourself, and you need to feel like that wherever you work, if you want to be the kind of person who wears a cute skirt and does her nails, that people should take you seriously. Or if you want to be someone who wears jeans and a t-shirt, people should take you seriously there too, as long as you're not violating some kind of dress code. Like if you're working somewhere where everyone has to dress up, then, you know, but still you should be able to wear a pantsuit if you want, yeah, or a skirt.
Well, one could also argue that dress codes on the whole are fairly, you know,
horrifying. Yeah. Well, I think that an imposed dress code is horrifying, but certainly there are a lot of professions where there's kind of an unspoken idea. I mean, you work with lawyers, so you know.
Yeah, the
lawyer problem. So
that's what it boils down to, the lawyer problem.
Yeah. And actually we have a lawyer.
Shakespeare was onto something.
We have a lawyer in this book who's a high-tech lawyer. Yeah. And she actually talks a little bit about some of those issues. So I had this great point that I was going to make, but now I can't remember what it was. So what were you going to say, Charlie?
Wow.
Something about being, oh, I know what I was going to say. Not only I think, you know, do we need to see women getting more leeway to express themselves however they want in terms of dressing at work, but men too. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the places that our culture is heading is giving men more freedom in terms of their gendered presentation as well. I think the metrosexual idea is just the tip of the iceberg, and that maybe in 40 or 50 years, men will be able to wear dresses just as much as women can wear pants. And I think that'll really make things a lot easier. I think that a lot of men will feel a lot more comfortable with themselves if they can do that, and that they'll also maybe feel a little bit less focused on how women look if they can have their own pretty curls and bows and dresses.
Or perhaps, talking again about this presentation, if we were to basically just destroy and demolish these male presentation and female presentation, there was more of a kind of like unisex sort of presentation, and no one, you know, maybe do you think that might actually be one of the solutions here?
Yeah, I mean, unisex is one way to go. I mean, maybe there'll be a bunch of people who like to dress unisex or present unisex, but there's always going to be people who want to be like frilly and curly, yeah, and there's always going to be people who want to be kind of butch and tough and wear big boots and heavy pants. And I don't want to take that away from people.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. I actually wanted to give you two the opportunity to respond to a particularly strange review of this book that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, in which Charlie is now covering her eyes.
We're slapping our knees.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a perfectly nice review.
Well, no, but let's talk about this. Okay, Olivia Bowler wrote this review, and she seemed misinformed about the omnipresent status of HTML. She claimed to consider herself a bit of a geek, but didn't seem to know what HTML, and she was also, you know, confused about what the audience for this book was. Now, since Bowler didn't get it, you know, can you inform our listeners who the audience for this book might be and why, you know, something like as omnipresent as HTML? I mean, what is the nature of geek? Maybe.
Well, you know, I mean, we felt very strongly that the book, on the one hand, should be accessible to sort of the general reader, but on the other hand, you know, part of the geek ethos is that you kind of don't talk down to people and you don't kind of explain stuff that people can find out pretty easily on their own, like what a sysadmin is, or you know, I think there's not a lot of jargon in the book.
There's definitely geeking. And this was a conversation that we had with our editor and with the publisher, and they said, well, maybe you might want to cut out the sections where, for example, in Rupa's essay, she talks about having a medical problem, and as a biologist, you know, she's a PhD in genomics. She's really fascinated, and she talks about going through looking at, you know, how her genes are expressing and like what kinds of proteins are in her body and what's causing this problem. And it's a great scene because it really demonstrates how geek consciousness works and how a woman can think this way in the same way a man can. And we push to keep that stuff in there. So there are moments in the book where someone who isn't super into reading about the ins and outs of genomics or the ins and outs of computer networking may find, I'll just skip that paragraph. But we really felt like that's super important. We wanted to represent the subjective experiences of these women, and that's part of their subjective experiences. It would be like saying, well, we're going to have a book about queers, but there can't be any queer sex in it. Yeah. You know, because that might alienate the average reader who's not familiar with the idea of a strap-on. You know, we feel like a smart reader can follow along. And we were a little confused by that review because she seemed to define geekiness as being able to use a cell phone.
Yeah.
And I think that the average geek, you know, is a lot more into technology than just cell phones. And if they're using a cell phone, they're using it to do Twitter and they're using it to do all kinds of other crazy crap. It's not just about phone calling. So,
In terms of who the audience for the book is, I mean, I think we were hoping it would definitely reach a geek audience, both male and female, but also we were hoping that it would, you know, reach a larger sort of feminist readership and anybody who's interested in the stories of women in science and technology and, you know, the issue of women being represented in science and technology. So we do want it to be accessible to a larger readership. And I think I feel really comfortable that it is accessible to a larger readership. I mean,
I think it is. We've gotten a lot of response from people who are just interested in sort of women's issues and issues of gender inequality, because really, in the end, it's a book about how do women enter a profession that has historically been male dominated? And it's a very basic question. It's a question that feminists and people interested in, you know, gender equality have been asking for decades.
Yeah.
And this is one of those holdout areas in the professions where it's still male dominated, unlike a lot of other professions, which have become much more integrated. And so it's an interesting case study in that way to sort of say, oh, wow, even in a culture which has been transformed by feminism, we still have these pockets of male domination. And how does it work? How do we integrate? And that's what we're seeing now, is how do we do that? And where do we go from here?
Well, let us hope we go somewhere. Very nice indeed. Charlie, Annalee, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.